Part 3 1. Thursday, April 13, 10 o'clock a.m. My plan for opening the Chicago World's Fair part of our tale was to explain why Henry James, against all his instincts and habits, would accompany Holmes on this part of the detective's adventure. But the odd truth is, I don't know why James did so. We all know individuals who shield their thoughts better than others, but both Sherlock Holmes and Henry James have been the most difficult minds to penetrate in my long experience both of knowing people and of entering the thoughts of characters. Holmes's tight grip on his secrets and modes of thinking is understandable. The detective is a self-made gentleman with a base and secret history from the London streets, and the majority of his life has been one long, dangerous, high-wire act of exercising both his astounding intellect and indomitable will. Holmes's mind and heart, what there is of a heart, work in ways both too alien and difficult for most of us to understand, or to bear if we could understand them. But Henry James's thoughts and feelings are hidden behind an even thicker layer of psychic armor. Like Holmes, James has created himself, the artist self, the master self, the married only to his art bachelor self, out of whole cloth and through sheer effort of will, perhaps following John Keats's dictum of, that which is creative must create itself. But unlike the detective, James has attempted to hide the core of himself even from himself. Every word he has ever written in letters, introductions, and fiction threatens to reveal something, however ephemeral, that the writer does not want revealed. His self-discipline in avoiding such revelations has been painfully effective. His success in keeping his inner thoughts and his reasons for most of the decisions in his life secret has led us to this point where we can only stand outside that tightly banded and seemingly contradicted construct that is Henry James, and wonder at his choices. At any rate, James has chosen to follow Holmes to Chicago, and I ask his pardon and yours for jumping ahead a couple of days in the strict chronology of the tale before doubling back to earlier events. On their second day in Chicago, Sherlock Holmes insisted on taking Henry James on a brief morning excursion tour by boat of the new white city of the Columbian Exposition. The small steamship left from a pier in downtown Chicago, not far from the hotel where they were staying. While never stopping at the exposition and carefully avoiding the huge pier with its automated people mover still under construction and extending far out into the lake from the World's Fair site, the tour gave gawkers a 90-minute glimpse of the exposition structures from Lake Michigan. "I'm not sure of the purpose of this outing," James said as he stood near Holmes at the starboard railing of the noisy little tour boat. The modern, three-decked steamship with rows of seats on each of its roofed levels could safely carry about 300 people. The ship was named Columbus and would be a ferry to the exposition after the official opening on May 1st, coming and going every hour to carry new revelers to the exposition grounds and exhausted fairgoers back to their downtown hotels. But today there were about 50 people aboard to take the short scenic cruise down to Jackson Park, and with the exception of James and the almost always impassive Holmes, all aboard seemed profoundly excited about the simple act of glimpsing some unfinished buildings. "I'm showing you the future," said Holmes. There had been a haze along the lakeshore when the tour boat left the downtown Chicago pier, but now, as they approached the Jackson Park area which held the fair, the haze lifted, and the sunlight took on an almost personal presence, warming the tourists and illuminating everything along the shoreline as if a huge searchlight had been trained on it. James knew that, technically, Jackson Park had been a southern extension of Chicago proper. Away from the shore, 63rd Street had boasted a few shops and homes already, but this square mile of lakefront now housing the exposition had been the worst sort of swampy, sandy, dead and desiccated place, unwanted even by the land speculators who'd hurled the boundaries of Chicago further and further out onto the prairie, following the deliberate extensions of the city's railroad system miles beyond the edges of the existing Chicago. America's newspapers, for almost 2 years, had enjoyed telling the tale of how the famous Eastern architects, the best in the nation, chosen by the exposition czar Daniel Hudson Burnham, had been horrified to learn that under a foot of black soil, all throughout the swampy islands of this Jackson Park site, construction diggers would encounter only more unsettling sand and super-saturated soil. Burnham had been asking these famous architects to design what would, for the duration of the exposition, be the largest structures in North America, and when Mr. Ferris's wheel would be completed in June, the tallest. On mud, quicksand really, rather than on the bedrock these architects were so used to in New York and elsewhere in the East. It took about an hour for carriages to travel from downtown Chicago to the fair site in Jackson Park, less time for the many yellow rail cars, called cattle cars by the exposition-savvy Chicagoans, that had been laid on to take the special spur line south straight to Jackson Park and the gates of the fair. When speculators had refused to rent or sell airspace over the avenues leading south to the fair for less than 100% profit for themselves, the railroad execs had designed the elevated special rail line to the fair with its constant stream of yellow cars tailored to fit down the narrow north-south alleys where no airspace needed to be purchased. It took the Columbus tour boat about 25 minutes to reach the fair site in Jackson Park. "Good heavens," said James. In almost 3 decades of living and traveling abroad, James had seen enough architectural wonders that most of the new structures that Americans seemed so proud of seemed small or ugly or far too utilitarian in comparison to the millenniums of beauty he'd seen in Europe. But the White City was something totally new to him. For a moment, he could only grip the rail and gawk. "My heavens," he said again after a breathless moment. What had been swampland had been transformed into more than a square mile of white stone walks, countless white buildings of immense and staggering size, soaring sculptures, giant domes, gracefully arching bridges, green lawns, a forested island, and fields of flowers. The daylight on the white buildings seemed to make the White City incandescent. James found himself squinting. Downtown Chicago was a relatively new city. Most of the buildings had been built since the terrible 1871 fire. But now the author realized that it was a dark, dirty, black city compared to the vision before him. In Chicago itself, dark brick buildings grew even taller to block the light from reaching the shorter buildings and sidewalks all around them. The cavernous streets were made even darker by the tracks for the elevated trains running overhead. Except for the rare buildings facing Lake Michigan, Chicago was a box canyon city of darkness, dirt, noise, and grime. James knew that his beloved London was equally dirty, or more so, but at least it had the good grace to hide its filth in the thick, dangerous coal fogs a good part of the year. Quiet until now, Holmes suddenly started playing the part of tour guide.
"There are 14 of those so-called great buildings in the White City. The huge one we're approaching now is called the Manufactures and Liberal Arts Building and encloses 1.3 million square feet of space. The roof itself is a clear span some 368 feet long and 206 feet high. It alone had 13 acres of surface to paint. Besides the great buildings, there are 200 more buildings in the White City, including one representing each of the 47 states in the Union, plus all territories."
James smiled, amused at having his own tour guide with a British accent. Some were edging closer along the railing to hear what Holmes was saying.
"When President Cleveland turns on the switch on the 1st of May," continued Holmes, either not noticing or simply ignoring the other listeners, "the White City's dynamos will provide 3 times the total amount of electric power available in Chicago, and more than 10 times that provided for the 1889 Paris Exposition. The White City has more than 120,000 incandescent lights and 7,000 arc lights to illuminate its boulevards, grounds, pathways, and fountains. There will be very few, if any, dark corners in the White City, and the designers have hired their own police force, the 2,000 members of the Colombian Guards, not only to apprehend those who have committed crimes or disturb the civic peace, but to stop those crimes before they occur. No other city in Europe or America has what I consider so enlightened a law enforcement policy. What's the huge but ugly and unfinished thing there, some distance north and a bit west of the big manufacturer's building? Asked James, gesturing with his walking stick. It looks as if they are building the hull for Noah's Ark. That's to be the White City's answer to the Eiffel Tower that was such a hit at the Paris Exposition, said Holmes. A certain Mr. Ferris is building a giant wheel that theoretically will carry up to 40 people in each of its 36 railcar-sized viewing cabins. The passengers will ascend some 264 feet into the air at the height of each revolution, giving, Mr. Ferris and the White City designers promise, an amazing view of Lake Michigan, the White City, including the Midway Pleasance with all of its other diversions, and the Chicago skyline. What you see there is only the framework of the bottom half of the huge wheel. They'll soon be bringing in and mounting an axle that I'm told is the heaviest piece of steel ever constructed on this continent. The axle shaft will be some 45 feet long and will weigh 46 tons, and will have to be strong enough to bear a burden of the wheel's own steel, carriages, and people that will amount to 6 times the weight of some cantilever bridge across the Ohio River at Cincinnati that you Americans seem so proud of. The White City people and Mr. Ferris keep promising that the great wheel will be finished and carrying passengers by the middle of the summer, if not earlier.
Where did you get all this information, Holmes? Said James. All these facts and figures don't sound like you.
Holmes turned his back on the White City, leaned back against the railing, and smiled.
It's true that I'm often arithmetically challenged, as my brother Mycroft has pointed out on far too many occasions. But I had a private tour yesterday while you were in the hotel talking to the ailing Mr. Clemens, and even a dullard can remember certain facts for a short period of time. It's how one passes through Cambridge or Oxford with honors, as I'm sure you know.
James watched the White City as the Columbus made a wide, cautious arc around the 2,500-foot-long pier extending into Lake Michigan, its surface covered with workers and carts, as the linear and then circular movable sidewalk took its final shape down the center of the wide pier.
It will cost 10 cents to ride on the sidewalk, the length of the pier where the steamers will drop you the half mile to the entrance of the exposition, said Holmes without turning around to look at it. My guess is that most first-time visitors will try it just for the novelty.
James marveled at the tidy lagoons and carefully groomed streams that ran through the entire White City. Someone had turned a muck-ridden swamp into a cleaner, wider, airier version of James's beloved Venice.
All in 21 months,
said James as if reading the author's mind.
Where then will President Cleveland be doing his opening speech and switch-turning?
Holmes turned and pointed with his own stick.
Do you see through the pillars of the peristyle to that dome rising at the far end of the lagoon? Right in line with that canvas-shrouded tall pedestal that will be revealed as St. Gordon's huge statue of the Republic? Yes, the one with the 4 pavilions, one at each corner. That is the administration building where the president and other dignitaries will speak. They will be facing this way, east, toward the lake and the statue, and one assumes that all the concourses will be flooded with excited American humanity, all the way back to the peristyle gates.
Holmes handed James a small folding telescope. The author put the object to his eye, brought the dome into focus, and said,
Are those angels on the upper promenade of that administration building, right below the dome?
8 groupings of angels, actually, said Holmes, all trumpeting the victory of peace, although I fear they may be a bit overly optimistic about that reality. Besides hundreds of incandescent lights outlining the upper reaches and dome of the administration building at night, that upper promenade you're looking at is ringed with those huge gas torches designed to illuminate the golden dome.
Good heavens, said James, turning his telescopic gaze on the myriad of what looked like huge marble palaces, each festooned with its own multitude of statuary, pinnacles, towers, arches, entablatures, and wildly decorated friezes. I'm surprised that the denizens of Chicago won't wish to move into the White City once the exposition is over, he said softly.
They'd be out of a home after a winter or two, or even after a few months of strong Chicago rainstorms, said Holmes.
James lowered the telescope. What do you mean?
While there's plenty of steel and iron, more than 18,000 tons of those metals in the great buildings alone, I'm told, not to mention wood, most of what looks like white marble to you is actually made of staff.
Staff?
That's what it's called, said Holmes. Evidently it's an exotic composition of plaster, cement, and hemp, or some similar fibrous material that was sort of painted on or sprayed on to look like permanent stone. All of the great buildings, most of the state buildings, and a vast majority of the statuary and bas-relief, you see, is made of staff. In its semi-liquid form, a very plastic material, I understand, and lighter than wood. Still, they used more than 30,000 tons of the stuff to create most of the White City's structures.
Not meant to be permanent?
Asked James, with a strange pang of disappointment. He found himself, against all reason and odds, taking pride in what his fellow Americans had created in so short a time.
No, said Holmes, although if painted regularly, it might last several years. Left to the elements, all those amazing structures you're admiring are going to melt and rot like Miss Havisham's wedding cake in a year or less.
James handed back the telescope, which Holmes folded and set in his large outer pocket. The Columbus made a wide easterly arc and headed back along the shoreline toward the Black City. He was thinking that no nation was better at creating metaphors for itself than America. In this case, the vision of a beautiful, sane, safe marble future that is all dream and no marble to sustain it.
Well, said James, still disappointed that his American Venice turned out to be so much marzipan. I guess the future of the White City is not our problem.
No, agreed Holmes. One way or the other, all our problems will be over by the end of May 1st.
2. Monday, April 10, 11:20 a.m. 3 days before James's boat tour to the White City and the day after he'd left his friends in Washington, the author stood at the family cemetery plot in Cambridge. He'd last visited this spot a little more than a decade earlier when he'd rushed to America to be by his dying father's side, only to learn when his feet touched the Boston Pier that his father had died an hour earlier. On the day of New Year's Eve, 1882, James had walked alone up the snowy hillside to his father's grave that had been filled in with the frozen earth only 10 days earlier. William, unable to return from Europe in time, had sent a most personal letter to his father, but the letter, like Henry, had arrived after the awful fact of death. It had been a very cold day, although with a clear Massachusetts winter sky, and James remembered both the ghost smoke of his breath in the air as he read the long letter and the growing numbness in his freezing toes. William's long letter had begun, "Darling old father," and had passed through several pages of metaphysical speculation that seemed to Henry much like the continuation of debates and outright arguments William had been having with their father for decades. The letter had ended with, "Good night, my sacred old father. If I don't see you again, farewell,
a blessed farewell. James was sure he had not wept that day a decade earlier, because if he had, the tears would have frozen to his cheeks. This April day was the antithesis of the last time he was here. In the winter then, he'd been able to see the whiteness of a distant field beyond the Charles River, but now leaves blocked most of that view, and as they shifted in the warm April breeze, James caught glimpses of homes and shops that hadn't been there in 1882. A year earlier, when William was in Italy, he'd had a marble urn engraved for Sister Alice's ashes. Henry read the words that William had chosen. Ed essa da martiro e da esilio venne a questa pace. James had recognized the passage at once, from the 10th book of the Paradiso in the Divine Comedy, and his translation from the Italian was roughly, "And from martyrdom and banishment it came unto this peace." It seemed appropriate for Alice's pain-filled and largely bedridden life. She had indeed embraced death as an escape for the final decades of her life, although James knew, better than anyone else in the family, that the pain and death-welcoming was, until very near the end, leavened by Alice's mischievous sense of humor and penchant for parody. When William had ordered her diary published, just for the family members, without asking Henry's opinion, Henry had been shocked by the names named and ridiculed. He would have edited the diary severely to avoid such insults to the living and some recent dead, but perhaps older brother William was right. Perhaps Alice defied editing. In one hand, James held the elegant snuffbox containing the small amount of his sister's ashes he'd pilfered after the cremation in England, while in the other hand he held the small gardening trowel he'd purchased in a hardware store not far from their old home on Bolton Street. But James had been as good as his vow not to go look at the now empty of family Bolton Street home, or to walk past the impressive home of William and his Alice, Alice the wife and mother, on the corner of 95 Irving Street here in Cambridge. James felt like he'd failed his sister. His plan had been honorable enough, to have one of the brothers, himself, as it had to be, rather than Miss Catherine Loring help spread Alice's ashes, but spread them somewhere Alice had been truly happy. James had simply failed to find such a spot, at least one where the happiness hadn't been dependent upon his sister's Boston marriage to Miss Loring, such as at the two's Newport home. James knew that he was being foolish and selfish with this after-the-fact jealousy of Catherine Loring. He'd never felt that way while Alice was alive. He'd simply been happy that someone could bring a smile to his sister's face or coax a laugh out of her. But since Sister Alice's death and Miss Loring's monopoly in bringing the ashes back here to this sacred spot, the James's burial ground, the jealousy and sense of stubbornness about finding a spot for these ashes had grown rather than diminished. But in the end, he had surrendered. There had always been a certain unique oneness about his sister. Alice James and her ashes should be together, or at least in close proximity. James wasn't about to try to pry open the sealed marble urn. Making certain that no one was watching him, James knelt and dug a small grave for the snuffbox. The jade and porcelain box had been given to James as a gift in the late 1870s by Richard Monckton Milnes, Lord Haughton, a friend of Henry James Sr. His father had described Haughton as energetic and fun-filled. Henry Adams, back then, had told young James that Haughton was the first wit of London and the maker of men, a great many men. But the Lord was 68 or 69 when Henry Jr. finally met him and was given to using elaborate breakfasts and dinners to capture famous artists and writers as if they were so many butterflies. The ivory snuffbox, for which James had no use save to own it as an object of art, was of the finest Delft porcelain, interset with tiny and delicately carved androgynous human figures which, in their flowing and blowing robes, seemed to be saints or cherubs descended from some 17th century painting. There was something spiritual in this little box, and it was made infinitely more so now by holding his beloved sister's ashes. As James set the little snuffbox into the small but deep little hole, and began troweling dirt back into place. He recalled an early dinner he'd had with Lord Houghton, where the fellow diners had included Tennyson, Gladstone, and Dr. Heinrich Schliemann, the fellow who had found and excavated Troy. Finished with his own excavation and filling in, Henry stood, feeling the sudden pang of pain in his always aching back, and brushed off his trousers at the knees. He realized that he should say a little prayer, but there was no prayer in his heart or mind at the moment. He'd already said his goodbyes to Alice. She was the only member of the family whose deathbed and long, difficult dying he'd actually attended. He took one last glance at the urn to fulfill any ceremony required.
Ed essa da martiro, ed da esilio, venne a questa pace.
In the handsome cab he'd kept waiting for him in the cemetery, James knew that he'd have to decide what he was going to do. There was only one sane and sensible course of action. The train for New York, for which he had a first-class ticket, left from Boston's Old Central Station in 1 hour. He'd made arrangements with the German steamship company to go aboard the Spree with all his baggage this very evening, as soon as he arrived in New York. He would have an excellent dinner and a good night's sleep in his first-class cabin aboard the elegant ocean liner, and the Spree would depart for Southampton, then London by rail, then home in the morning. James would not even have to get dressed to go to the deck to watch the departure, since no one was seeing him off. He'd simply sleep late and enjoy breakfasting in his cabin. But there was the double issue of that damn telegram from Holmes, ordering him to meet the detective on Beacon Hill this afternoon, long after his train had departed, Holmes arrogantly moving him around as if he were a chess piece with no mind of his own. And, more importantly, James's news for Holmes about Professor Moriarty and the astounding meeting of thugs and anarchists that James had risked his life to witness. That was hardly something that James could put in a letter, even if he knew where in damnation Sherlock Holmes was at any given time, much less in a telegram. Well, he'd have to decide soon. The hansom driver was showing signs of irritation, and so was his horse. Logically, there was only one choice he could make. He had to get out of this nightmare. He had to get to the train station, get on that train to New York, have his luggage and himself transferred to the ship, and settle into his stateroom on the Spree. Every bit of logic and reason screamed to James that it was time to return to his flat at De Vere Gardens and get back to work on the play that was going to make him a fortune. "Driver," he called, "to the Central Railway Station, and quickly." 3. Monday, April 10, 3:38 p.m. Holmes ostentatiously checked his watch when the hansom, which had been moving almost at a gallop, came to a stop and a red-faced Henry James stepped out.
"You're almost 8 minutes tarder, James," said Holmes. "I was about to give up on you and go on about my business."
James had paid the driver, and now his face grew even redder.
"Don't you dare chide me for being late for this rendezvous. First of all, you insult me in a public telegram, telling me to come if it's convenient or even if it is not convenient. That may have been a misfired attempt at humor, Mr. Holmes, but it was not something a gentleman would do when communicating via public telegraphy with another gentleman. And as for the time, first of all, you very well remember that I lost my valuable watch when you were dragging me through Rock Creek Cemetery and less speakable places at midnight, so I've had to depend upon public timepieces, which are notoriously unreliable in America. And finally, I had to rush to the Central Boston Railway Station to get my luggage and accompany it through heavy traffic to this new North Union Station, which isn't really north at all, but far west of the city center. Then I had to store my luggage at the new station, which is deucedly crowded this time of day, and then fight Bostonians, who are only half a step up on the Darwinian scale from South Seas cannibals when it comes to refusing to learn how to queue for a hansom cab to bring me back here. And I shan't bother to tell you what important plans of my own that this has ruined for me since—"
James stopped because Holmes was openly smiling at him, which made James all the more angry and red-faced.
"Such as missing the sailing of the Spree tomorrow evening?" said Holmes.
How could you know? Where did you—"
spluttered James.
"Alas," said Holmes, "even our beloved telegraphy, whether sending communications between gentlemen or just to book a ship's passage, is not as private as it should be. There remain papers and copies of papers easily accessible to the dedicated voyeur, especially if that dedicated voyeur enters the telegraph office only a moment after the cable sender has departed. And it is helpful if one can read words upside down, a small trick which I mastered as a child."
James folded his arms across his chest above the curve of his significant belly while attempting to hold in the angry words and sentences that flowed into his mind. The cab hadn't left, and Holmes called to the driver,
"Wait here, another 15 minutes or so, my dear man."
He handed up some folded currency. The cabbie nodded, touched the brim of his hat, and pulled the hansom to the curb on the opposite side of the street.
"You think this business here will take only 15 minutes?
Hissed James in low tones so the driver would not hear.
"I missed my train and ship to England for something that will take only 15 minutes?
"Of course not," said Holmes. "As promised, we leave for Chicago in—"
he checked his watch again—
"a little under 90 minutes. But our immediate problem, as you can see, is that there is no 426½ address here. The houses on this side of the street go straight from 426 to 428.
James sighed, obviously wondering at the denseness of a man whom too many people had called a genius.
"The custom here on this part of Beacon Hill is to have a little room on the upper floor of a carriage house," said James. "Those are the halves that the postal service delivers to."
"Aha!"
said Holmes, as if he'd been the one to come up with this widely known fact.
"There's a carriage house or garage down this driveway at 426,
he said as he started walking down the paved lane. James caught the tall detective by the sleeve.
"The protocol is to approach the carriage house apartments by walking down the alley. We'll need to go down this way and turn left to find the alley entrance."
"What an absurd protocol," said Holmes, following reluctantly. "The carriage house is visible right there."
He flung out his left arm, although they'd already lost sight of the carriage house at the end of the sloping driveway. As they turned left on another street, all these streets and many of these homes were familiar to James from both his childhood and his visits home to Bolton Street as an adult. The writer grasped Holmes's upper arm and said,
"I have urgent information for you, Holmes. Seriously urgent. Far more important than checking on this address, which shall almost certainly be a dead end. Let me tell you how 2 days ago I—"
Holmes gently removed the author's hand from his arm and said softly,
"I have no doubt that you do have something important to tell me, James, but one thing at a time, old boy. We shall speak to whomever lives at this address, and then be on our way to North Station, and you may tell me whatever you have to say more at your, let's say, leisure."
James almost turned around and left then. His face grew as red as it had been when he'd arrived, and he glared at the side of Holmes's head. He promised himself that he wouldn't say a single word about anything until Holmes asked him for it. So what if he, Henry James, knew the details for Professor Moriarty's plans for multiple assassinations and an anarchist and mob uprising set for May 1st. If Holmes was going to continue acting this way, Henry James would be damned if he'd share such vital intelligence with a detective.
"Who lives in these one-half-numbered carriage house apartments?" Holmes asked, as if that were the most important thing for him to learn that day. "The servants?"
James considered not answering, but his cultivated nature demanded he answer a simple question.
"No. Just as in England, if a family can afford servants, they live in the main house, up on the top floor under the eaves, usually. These cottages have a tradition of being rented at very low prices to white people, cultivated people, whose jobs or vocations have steeped them in poverty. Local teachers, for instance, or the occasional college student, although the latter is often considered too volatile for these quiet neighborhoods, unless vouched for by multiple letters of reference, of course.
Of course, said Holmes.
He'd found the stairway up to the room or rooms over the still-active carriage house, active if the strong scent of manure from the barn level was any indicator, and took the steps upward two at a time in his eager anticipation. After several knocks, giving James time to climb the steps more slowly and stand puffing a bit on the landing outside the door, a small, gray-haired lady with cataracts clouding her right eye cautiously opened the door. Holmes removed his top hat.
Good afternoon, madam. My name is Sherlock Holmes, and this is my associate, Dr. Excuse me, Mr. James. We've come because I'm an old friend of Miss Irene Adler, the lady to whom you forward the letters sent here to a certain Miss Rebecca Lorne Baxter, and I wish to find her most recent address.
What did you say your name was?
Asked the old lady.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, madam, he said more slowly. And whom do I have the pleasure of addressing?
The woman with the white hair, pale white skin, and white cataract paused before saying,
Mrs. Gaddis.
Were you, by any chance, a teacher for many years, Mrs. Gaddis? Asked Holmes. Your diction suggests you were.
I taught for 28 years, before retiring with commendations and honors, and I don't receive a decent enough pension to afford these tiny 2 rooms over a smelly stable,
said Mrs. Gaddis.
But your name was never mentioned to me by the lady who pays me $5 a month to forward her mail. So I'm afraid I must close the door, Mr. Holmes.
As gently as he could, Holmes blocked the door from closing with his left foot, and a seemingly casual hand set flat on the windowless door.
She must have left some instructions for my arrival, he said quickly. I know how playful Miss Adler is. Some puzzle or question by which I could identify myself and receive her address from you.
Mrs. Gaddis squinted with her one good eye.
The lady who pays me for passing along her mail, and I shan't say where that final destination for her mail is, nor even if it's under a different name than the Mrs. Lorne Baxter you mentioned, did say that some day an Englishman with a Yorkshire accent might come knocking at my door, and if he did, I should put a question to him to verify his identity.
Holmes had been holding his silky top hat in his hand, but now he almost set it atop his greased back hair and tipped it symbolically.
I am that London gentleman she designated, he said happily, trying to jolly the dour Mrs. Gaddis into greater cooperation. Perhaps you can tell by my English accent.
Accents can be put on like hats or socks, said Mrs. Gaddis, still frowning. But I shall ask you the question my benefactress told to me, if I can remember it properly.
James almost smiled as Holmes's face showed a quick glimpse of panic at this being a dead end in his quest to find Irene Adler, all because of an elderly former teacher's faulty memory. But age obviously hadn't clouded her mind as thoroughly as her vision.
Here's the question I'm to put to the Englishman caller, said Mrs. Gaddis,
pulling it from her memory as if taking an aging sheet of parchment down from some high shelf.
What were my last words to him at our last brief meeting?
Holmes laughed.
Her last words to me were, Good night, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, he said. But I didn't recognize her when she said it, because my friend Dr. Watson and I were in the act of unlocking the door of our home on Baker Street, when this thin young lad, short hair slicked back under a derby and wearing an oversized ulster with the collar turned up, said it in passing. Miss Adler was an actress and enjoys, or at least enjoyed, disguises almost as much as I do.
The words were correct,
said Mrs. Gaddis, still frowning.
You wait here, and I'll find the copy I made out of her forwarded mail address.
Mrs. Gaddis was back in less than half a minute. James peered past Holmes into her small but tidy, almost cozy apartment, and she handed Holmes the note card and said,
I believe that completes our conversation, Mr. Holmes.
The detective held up a finger in protest.
Not at all, he said happily. Common decency, to say nothing of courtesy, compels me to pay you a very little something as mere metaphor for my sincere appreciation of the service you have been carrying out for my friend, Miss Adler, as well as for your help to me in finding that old friend.
Mrs. Gaddis shook her head, held up a blocking hand, and was about to say no when Holmes handed her a $20 bill and released it so she had to grasp it. Whatever she was going to say, she didn't.
Teachers are the most underappreciated and least recompensed of all our esteemed professional classes, Holmes said quickly, ignoring Mrs. Gaddis's half-hearted attempts to hand the bill back to him.
This time he did tip his hat and secure it firmly on his head before clattering down the steps. James nodded and smiled his own faux appreciation before following Holmes. While riding to North Station, James asked to see the address the retired teacher had given Holmes. It was, he recognized, very near, if not quite, on DuPont Circle in Washington.
So she never left Washington after all,
murmured the author.
I'm quite sure that Henry Adams and John Hay have believed her gone all these years.
It's Adams that gave me this Beacon Hill mail address, said Holmes. And she's been responding from there for years. Obviously, Irene Adler posts the return letter from Washington with an envelope included with her handwriting and the Beacon Hill return address, and Mrs. Gaddis dutifully transfers the letter and posts it from Boston for $5 per month help on her rent.
You're certain that Rebecca Lorne and Irene Adler were the same person? Said James.
Absolutely certain. If I hadn't been before, the identifying question of her last words to me that night in London, I believe Watson wrote that case up under the title A Scandal in Bohemia, a nonsensical title, because he felt that he had to hide the identity of the English royal personage.
I'm only surprised that your friend Dr. Watson did not have the king exit pursued by a bear, said James.
Holmes looked at James blankly for a few seconds, and then exploded in that high, almost cawing, full laughter that James had heard only a few times. Holmes's sharp barks of laughter always startled James.
Anyway, it was, I believe, the first telling of my cases, the first short story about the Sherlock Holmes character, I should say, that appeared in the Strand magazine.
James had read that story the previous week. It had been in Clara Hayes' collection of Holmes's stories, or Arthur Conan Doyle's stories. James was not sure which description applied to reality, if any reality there was.
I always suspected that Irene Adler had remained in Washington, Holmes was saying.
Why?
Holmes reminded James of the bouquet of white violets that appeared as if by magic on Clover Adams's grave every December 6th.
But you're not rushing to Washington to confront her, said James.
They were approaching Union Station here in the western reaches of Boston.
No, said Holmes. We have tickets for Chicago and much to do there. Besides, the mailing address near DuPont Circle will not be Irene Adler's address, only another dead end, and this one quite deadly.
James nodded and made an almost swimming motion in the air, moving that finished discussion aside.
May I now tell you the details of what I discovered in Washington this past Saturday? Said James. I assure you it's of the utmost importance.
We're at the station already, and we have to meet someone here, said Holmes. Why don't you tell me when we get to our first-class carriage? It will just be the three of us.
Three of us? Repeated James.
Four. Monday, April 10, 4:10 p.m. To Henry James, the new North Railway Station was Boston's celebration of the modern age. The architecture was noble and the layout oozed common sense. Rather than wait outside in the cold and damp under a gigantic open shed roof as in London's great and small stations, here one went down a ramp inside the sprawling structure, and the train came into you on a warm and well-ventilated lower level. When they'd arrived, James had said, "I'll have to go claim my bags for transfer." But Holmes had taken the handful of baggage check tickets and said, "I'll find some expert help in getting that done for us," and had disappeared for only a moment into the grand lobby crowd before returning.
"Are you sure?"
began James. His continuing nightmare was having his steamer trunk or other pieces of his baggage, including the portmanteau filled with beginnings of his stories and the long, thrice-bescribbled scripts for his current and future plays, disappear during one of these American railway adventures. How much happier he would have been, he realized, if both he and his luggage were safely aboard the good ship Spray and safely out of sight of land by now. Holmes led the way through the mob and down the graceful ramps to where signs announced that their train to Chicago would be leaving in 15 minutes.
"Here you are, Mr. Holmes, Mr. James, sir,"
piped up an unmistakably Cockney voice. James was startled at the sight of a short, rail-thin lad, whose unself-conscious grin showed where adult teeth had grown in, only to be knocked out. The boy was obviously of that group known in London as street Arabs, since before Charles Dickens's day. Yet he was dressed well in English spring tweed suit with tailored jacket and waistcoat, proper knicker trousers and quality wool knee socks, and well-polished quality London-made shoes. Even his cap, which he'd swept off when he'd presented Holmes and James with the baggage cart, piled high with their luggage, was new and well-made, probably in Scotland.
"Give the tickets to that porter 2 coaches down, and he'll arrange our luggage properly," directed Holmes. "Bring back to our compartment Mr. James's portmanteau, it has his initials on it, and my briefcase and small tan carrying case."
"Right you are, Governor,"
said the boy, and disappeared in the gathering crowd, pulling the massive baggage cart behind him.
"You trust that strange child?" asked James.
Holmes gave him a strange half-smile.
"More than you can know, James," he said softly. "More than you can know."
The detective went to a nearby stand to purchase some newspapers and magazines for the trip, so they hadn't yet boarded when the boy returned, handing James his portmanteau and Holmes 2 well-traveled pieces of personal luggage, along with a new set of baggage check slips. The boy stared straight at the author with a look that fell just short of insolence, but certainly was not appropriately deferential.
"Nice to see you again, Mr. James," said the boy.
James heard the "Mr. James," and could almost name the streets within hearing distance of the bells of St. Mary-le-Bow Church, where this young Cockney had eked out his living in London. James thought of all the porters and messengers they'd met or used on this trip, but none matched up with this strangely well-dressed lad, and he was sure he'd never seen the boy before this trip. So he said coolly,
"I don't believe we've ever met, young man."
Again that too wide, unself-conscious, missing-toothed smile.
"But you saw me, and I saw you a-seeing me, sir."
James smiled but shook his head.
"I don't believe so."
The boarding area had emptied out, as most of the rushing passengers up near the first-class cars had already gone aboard to claim their cabins. James and the boy were about 10 or 12 feet apart when the youngster walked quickly toward the rider, so quickly and with such a sense of confidence bordering on aggression that James found himself gripping his walking stick with both hands. But the boy stopped only a pace or two in front of James, threw both arms in the air as if he were celebrating something, and, almost faster than the eye could follow, did 2 arching back handsprings, landing on his hands, flipping even higher to come down on his feet again, and not pausing even an instant there before performing a complete somersault in midair, his body descending parallel to the concrete boarding platform in the fraction of a second before Holmes grabbed the spread legs, now wrapped securely around Holmes's middle, and held the boy poised there horizontally, with nothing but Holmes's powerful fingers and hands keeping him up. Then Holmes gave a sort of juggler's cry. The boy put his palms together, arms straight above him as if he were diving into water rather than onto an unyielding concrete platform or iron tracks, and in a display of strength almost beyond James's comprehension, Holmes gripped the rigid boy's calves and extended the diver's form higher than the detective's or James's shoulders, then gave another cry. James realized dully that it was one acrobat's communication with another. He tossed the boy spinning out over the platform, caught him by the ankles, and held the lad there vertically, the boy's praying hands almost touching the platform. Then Holmes went to one knee. The boy used that knee as a diving board and leaped forward in a perfect head-first arc, hugging his knees as he turned in the air to land lightly on his feet in front of James, arms still over his head. The movements had jogged James's memory.
Good God! The two of you? The chimney sweeps on the Cameron's rooftop! Gasped James.
Holmes gave one of his quick twitches of a smile.
You had a mohawk strip of orange hair, accused James, pointing at Holmes. And you, spikes of green hair, he said to the boy.
It's nice to be appreciated, Governor, grinned the lad.
James was still blinking like a sun-blinded lizard. He turned toward Holmes again.
Why the flying Vernettis?
My grandmother on my mother's side was a Vernet, said Holmes, giving the name its proper French pronunciation. The Vernets were artists. I felt that the flying Vernettis sounded suitably acrobatic.
To what possible purpose? Cried James. All that week, Hay and others told me, the two acrobatic chimney sweeps had done the Cabot Lodge's home, Don Cameron's, where I saw you perform, even Hay's house, where you'd stayed.
I needed certain documents, Holmes said coolly. Old letters, to be precise, although at least one lady's diary was included. It's so nice, after the sweeps have laid down newspapers on every surface in Milady's boudoir to keep the soot from covering everything. They lock the door to the room and tell servants to stay clear.
Those bedroom fireplaces are tiny things, began James.
Mr. Henry James, said Holmes, stepping forward, I take great pleasure in introducing you to Wiggins II.
James remembered the telegram from Holmes's brother Mycroft he'd sneakily read. Wiggins II arrived safely in New York today.
What happened to Wiggins I?
He heard himself asking.
Oh, he grew up to where he was of no further use to me, said Holmes.
Also, laughed Wiggins II, my brother's in the clink.
For what crime?
Asked James.
The Holy Trinity, sir, said Wiggins II. Breaking, entering, and resisting arrest. He'll be there a few years, sir.
Wiggins II also answers to the name Morph, said Holmes. Sometimes pronounced in the old English form that rhymes with moat.
Since a mere moat, but a mighty moat I am indeed, Mr. James, said the boy.
A conductor stepped down and spoke through a cloud of steam.
It's time to board, gentlemen.
It turned out that the Wiggins II Moth had his own first-class bedroom, right next to the one shared by Holmes and James, but the boy stayed in their compartment until the train had left the Boston suburbs behind, and they were flashing past small white farms, stone walls, and green pastures.
Well, I guess I'll go check on what the Yanks call a club car and round me up a pint,
Wiggins II said, sliding open the compartment door.
They won't sell alcohol to a boy, said James.
Oh, no, sir,
agreed the moth, clinking coins together in his pocket.
But they understand that I'm just fetching a couple of glasses for me two guardians, kindly gentlemen that they are.
Then they were alone, and Holmes leaned forward and spoke to James where he sat dazed on the bench opposite.
You had something private and important to tell me, James?
Caught off guard, James needed a minute to arrange the events of the previous weekend in succinct but complete form, but then the words came rolling out of him.
You actually saw Professor Moriarty on the street and followed him?
Interrupted Holmes with a tone of amazement.
Yes, that's what I've been telling you.
How did you know it was Moriarty?
Because I looked at his photograph in the Mathematics Physics magazine at the Library of Congress, spluttered out James, and he was photographed in Leipzig just last year, 1892, so I knew you'd lied twice. Once to the world with your and Dr. Watson's tale of you and the professor dying at Reichenbach Falls, and then you lying to me about having only made up Moriarty, created him as a figment of your imagination, were your exact words. Why did you lie to me, Holmes?
The detective's cool gray gaze met the author's angry gray glare.
Anything I've said that distorted the truth in some small way was done to protect you from harm, James, said Holmes. Distorted the truth in some small way, repeated James with a dramatic scoffing noise.
I'd say that denying the existence of Professor James Moriarty and his plans for assassinations and widespread anarchy and riots is a bit more than some small way.
Holmes only nodded slowly, as if not in full agreement yet on the seriousness of his infraction to honor, trust, friendship, and it just made Henry James all the more angry.
Professor Moriarty is a fiend in human form, Holmes. I saw him. I heard him. He was planning and coordinating the deaths of hundreds of people, the unwitting police in a dozen cities, the President and Vice President of the United States, God knows how many innocent bystanders, as coolly as a businessman might announce a new sales campaign to his staff.
That's rather well put, James, Holmes said with another twitch of an approving smile. Well said indeed.
James only grunted. He was in no mood to receive Mr. Sherlock Holmes's approval.
Continue with your story of Saturday afternoon's encounter, said Holmes.
Later, James was surprised to see from Holmes's watch that it had taken him another half hour to tell the whole story. He was blushing slightly, since the part about concealing himself while the mob members took turns firing shotguns and rifles at the rat was more florid and less likely than any fiction he'd ever produced. James readied himself for a long cross-examination, an interrogation from the slightly frowning detective. But all Holmes said was,
How did you feel?
How did I feel?
James realized that he had almost shouted the words, glanced apprehensively toward the compartment's closed doors, and moderated his tone.
All that information for you, times of the assassination, plans for mob uprising and anarchists' murders across the United States, in London and in Europe, and you want to know how I felt?
Yes, said Holmes. For instance, when you thought they were shooting at you, and the shotgun blast shook the entire beam you were hiding on. How did you feel, James?
The author had to pause a moment. He knew that the question really did not deserve an answer. There were far too many important questions he could and should have answered about the assembly of thugs and Professor Moriarty's plans. But he also realized that he'd quietly been asking himself the same question for the last 2 days.
How had he felt during this,
the most out of all context, almost absurdly unreal feeling event of his lifetime?
Frightened?
Yes, but that was not the primary sensation.
Alive, he said at last. I felt very much alive.
Holmes grinned his full grin, patted James's knee as if the master author were a retriever dog who'd brought back the pheasant unchewed, and said,
That being the case, I think you are going to enjoy the next couple of weeks.
5. Wednesday, April 12, 8:05 a.m. Holmes arrived in Haymarket Square and immediately spotted Inspector Bonfield standing across the street near the alley. Carriage and cargo traffic was heavy on Desplaines Street, as was pedestrian traffic. Holmes waited for a break in the traffic and jogged across the street, accepting the inspector's eager handshake almost before Holmes had come to a stop.
"It's very good to see you again, Mr. Holmes," said Inspector Bonfield.
"And you, Inspector. Congratulations on your various promotions."
Holmes had been here in May and June of 1886, gathering evidence for the trial of the anarchists who'd been behind the Haymarket riot, where 8 policemen and 3 civilians had died. Bonfield had been a captain then, but the information he'd brought to the prosecution in the trial of the 8 anarchists had quickly earned him inspector status and the supervision of the Chicago Police Department's Detective Bureau. Bonfield had also been detached to the Columbian Exposition to train and supervise the 200 or so plainclothes detectives who, among them, knew the face and modus operandi of every pickpocket, thief, and con artist in a 7-state region. The so-called Columbian Guard, all decked out in baby blue uniforms and, on occasion, their red and yellow capes, carried a cute little ornamental sword. Bonfield's plainclothes boys carried a heavy sap, a pair of brass knuckles, and a loaded pistol in their suit pockets. "The promotions were aimed poorly," said Bonfield, who still seemed as quiet, reserved, and competent as Holmes had found him 7 years earlier. "All accolades should have gone to you, Mr. Holmes." The detective waved that away.
"I see you have a statue commemorating that May 4th, said Holmes, "and a uniformed police officer to guard it."
Bonfield nodded.
"That's a 24-hour guard, Mr. Holmes. Vandals, either the anarchists or those countless thousands who've come to look at the anarchist killers as social heroes, have beaten the statue apart with sledgehammers, scribbled obscene graffiti on it, painted it green. Very disrespectful. So now we keep a man here all day and all night."
Holmes pulled out his pipe and began tamping in tobacco. Henry James had convinced him, for the sake of his American friends, if for no other reason, to use a more expensive and less shockingly aromatic brand of tobacco while he was here in the States.
"You will never guess what is scheduled for Waldheim Cemetery for the day of May 4th, said Bonfield,
showing more anger in his expression than Holmes had ever before seen in that stable younger man.
"Waldheim," repeated Holmes,
puffing his pipe to life and setting away in his trouser pocket, next to the .38 caliber lemon squeezer pistol, the unique lighter.
"That's where the 4 hanged anarchists were buried, was it not?"
"It was," said Bonfield. "Now it's a shrine to the brave union organizers who ambushed my men and me here 7 years ago. They're unveiling a monument to the killers, or martyrs to the popular press's point of view. And the monument is said to be taller than this 20-foot statue memorializing the 8 police who died that day. Early estimates suggest that there may be 8,000 or more people turning out in Waldheim Cemetery for the radical ceremony. We wouldn't get a dozen citizens if we held a memorial service here for the